podcast for the biggest storylines, results, and controversies from the tennis world. Today is Wednesday, April 10th. I have to admit, didn't suck to have just one event I needed to follow on the calendar today. Now, do I miss having tennis at all hours of the day? I certainly do, but to be able to lock in on the 1,000 level ATP action happening in Monte Carlo this week feels like a valuable experience for everyone who follows the tennis world closely, because we get to see just about all of the best tennis players in the world compete in Monte Carlo. And certainly on Wednesday, we got to see the 2024 clay court debuts of Jannik Sinner, Daniil Medvedev, who of course sit at the top of the men's game right now, and as always remain two of the top contenders in every draw they enter, regardless of surface. Each of them looked pretty darn good in straight set round two victories. Obviously, again, given we only have one event on the calendar this week, I was able to lock in not just on those two matches today, I was able to lock in on all 10 of the results we saw emerge from Monte Carlo, all of them round two battles. We did have two other matches on the calendar today. Each of them ended prematurely by rain. They'll pick up again tomorrow morning, but 10 results, that's more than enough for us to have plenty of things to discuss here on today's show. And again, given there's only one event on the calendar, that's the agenda here on today's podcast. I want to offer my thoughts on all 10 results we saw on Wednesday in Monte Carlo. That doesn't mean I'm going to spend 5-10 minutes on each and every match, but certainly have some thoughts, and I want to share them all with you listeners today. Of course, quick note before we get started on all things Monte Carlo, it's our final weekend of college tennis regular season coverage on ESPN Plus. We'll have broadcast of everything happening in the Big 12, which features the top women's team in the country in Oklahoma State, two of the top four men's teams in Texas TCU, three top 10 teams if you include the Oklahoma men in there as well. We'll have that conference on display Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Again, it's the final weekend of their regular season, so if you want to check that action out, we'll have it for you at all hours of the day. And again, that's Thursday through Sunday this weekend for the Big 12 on ESPN+. Plus, we also have our last weekend of ACC coverage, where our reigning NCAA Division I champions, UNC Virginia, reside. That coverage Friday, Sunday on ESPN+. Plus, we have SEC coverage Friday, Sunday as well. Big 10 coverage Friday, Sunday on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel. We also will have coverage of just about every round of the 2024 NCAA tournament. That coverage will be spread out across both our YouTube channel and ESPN+ Plus as well. So be on the lookout for all of that. And again, if you are curious, why are we here at Cracked Rackets so compelled by the college tennis universe? Well, the results of Ben Shelton, Danielle Collins, Cam Nori, Emma Navarro, and others speaks to why we love watching college tennis as just a pathway for future pros to develop. But it's the most passionate, enthusiastic level of tennis I think we have across the tennis universe. And if you are curious about everything that's going on, you need a primer on the 2024 season. We got you covered here at Cracked Rackets. We recap the Division I men's and women's seasons every week. Tuesday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern time for the D1 women. Wednesday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern time for the D1 men on our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel. Those episodes posted as Great Shot podcast episodes the next day. I also am so fortunate to have the opportunity to speak with so many coaches, players from throughout the college tennis universe. Those conversations typically housed on our Cracked Interviews podcast feed. So again, just fair warning, I will be plugging all of our college tennis coverage quite frequently moving forward here, as it's something we are really proud of and something we are looking forward to putting together for all of you in the tennis universe. If you, again, are curious as to why we talk about it so frequently, why we remain so engaged with everything happening in college tennis, come check out our coverage, and I'm pretty sure you'll understand why. Again, so much of it this weekend, Thursday through Sunday, on ESPN Plus and our Cracked Rackets YouTube channel, coverage of the 2024 NCAA tournament on the horizon as well. Also, before we begin, thank you to all of you listeners for tuning in, day out. Always appreciate your support. It's why we have these increased opportunities that we do. A thank you, of course, to super producer Daniel Westhoff, the man behind the scenes who makes everything possible. And last but not least, a thank you, of course, to the support we get from our friends at Tennis Point for the latest and greatest equipment at the best prices, tennis-point.com. The promo code is CR15. All right, Let's talk about Wednesday's round two results in Monte Carlo. I think there's only one place we can start here on today's show, and that's with the elevation of Yannick Sinner. For me, he's reached that final tier. He's elevated himself to must-watch television every time he steps on court. And some of you longtime Mini Break listeners may remember me having this conversation with in regards to Iga Świątek, who, as I allude to, probably far too frequently for your viewers, you listeners liking. You know, I joke she's not eliminated from the greatest of all time race. Why do I make that joke? It's just to lend historical perspective. It's my routine reminder in the most hyperbolic way possible to catch your attention that we are in the midst of someone who is clearly on pace to do some historic things. Some, I don't want to say unmatched, but very few players will be able to match the resume, it feels like, given the pace she's playing at for Iga Świątek once her career has concluded. I don't know if Yannick Sinner is going to be an ATP Pantheon level player, if it will be, you know, elevated a big five by the time he and Alcaraz are done, and they'll have racked up the accomplishments that Federer, Nadal, Djokovic all achieved. I mean, the idea of anyone reaching 20 Grand Slam titles ever again feels so ludicrous to even speak out loud. And again, Yannick Sinner at 22 years old, which is a later start than any of the other players who are qualifying for this list, Yannick Sinner has one slam title at this point of his career. Any projecting you'd want to do is exactly that. It would be projection. However, that's not the tier I've elevated him to. I am talking about must-watch television in the sense that you're watching someone who is playing the sport just about as well as it could be played at any given moment. Someone who, as I alluded to on earlier podcasts throughout the course of this season, over the past couple of weeks in particular, I just think the base level, the floor he brings, match in, match out, I think it's the highest of anyone we have in the men's game right now. And obviously, hot take there, Alex. Wow, Yannick Sinner, who's what, 23-1? Overall this season, you think his base level is the highest level we've seen from any player this season? No duh, but it's more than that. Again, it elevates beyond just the statistics, which of course to this point of the season are absolutely laughable. You look at what Yannick Sinner has done. He's number one right now in hold percentage in this 2024 season. He's number two in break percentage, but over the 30% threshold, which on the men's side signifies the elite of the elite. Again, Yannick Sinner, through this 23-1 start to the year, he's holding serve 93.9% of the time. That would be the highest single season number I have ever seen, higher than an Isner, higher than a Kyrgios, higher than any of those traditional big servers you would think of. Right now, through a serious sample size, 24 matches, Yannick Sinner, 93.9% hold percentage. He's also breaking serve 32% of the time, which is right there with the career averages of the two best returners ever by percentage, Djokovic and Nadal. I mean, again, mathematically, he is playing the sport right now as well as it can be played. And I always say, I use statistics in this sport. I know I use them a lot to communicate with you listeners. I think it's the best mechanism to try to often display the point I am trying to make. But it matches up precisely with what you see with the eye test, right? The fact that Yannick Sinner breaks Seppi Korda right out of the gates in what was a 6-1, 6-2 victory for Yannick Sinner in his first clay court match of the season, a match where he made fewer than 50% of his first serves and won 95% of his first serve points. And to see, again, the fear that was in every shot Seppi Korda hit, he was afraid of going to the outer thirds because he didn't want to open up any space for Sinner to attack, not just for Sinner to, you know, take a ball early on the rise down the line and beat him to the spot. No, it was the idea of the weight of Sinner's shot pushing Korda even further in a cross-court exchange into the outer third and just, again, sapping the strength out of his legs and opening up these clear lanes to attack where Sinner taking the ball early on the rise right now just so well, almost, again, bunting down on backhands at times and finds the backhand cross and finds the outer third of the backhand. Again, it's not just the depth he generates, but it's the heaviness of that ball, the fact that it's clearly moving to the player's left and further towards the alley and further outside the court when Sinner hits that backhand cross. It's not just a flat shot. No, there's action on it as well. How heavy he hits the ball on this surface, it's just lethal. And the movement is now to a point where this surface provides him that much more time to get into his playbook. And because he hits the ball heavier than anyone else, his ball is that much more effective than anyone else's. You know, you're, as his opponent, you're pushed into the corner that much more harshly than you are capable of imposing upon him. I mean, there was, I think it was early in the second set where Korda hits a perfect, perfect backhand drop shot. And somehow Sinner, with those long levers on the full sprint, a sliding little flick of the wrist, cross court redraw or passing shot as Korda had closed in behind did. And you're just like, well, if he's making that too, I'm not going to win today. And again, Sinner breaks Korda right out of the gates, never lets go. So, not that he made a lot of first serves, but so consistent behind that first strike now. I don't think anyone executes that first strike more effectively nor efficiently. He's a comfortable volleyer. Again, he's sliding into his shots now, which this is how you know in clay court season, because I'm saying it for a second straight podcast, that's the difference between good and great movers. Good movers slide out of the shot. Great movers slide into it. Sinner's just able to do that now effectively. He worked Seppi Korda. And again, Korda was afraid of hitting the ball hitting the ball into the outer thirds of the court because he just didn't want to give Sinner anything to work with. He tried to overwhelm Sinner with depth and pace through the center and force Sinner to be the one to overreact or force Sinner to be the one to make the move too soon, and it just didn't work. Like, Sinner didn't give him any errors. The heaviness of the Sinner forehand really broke down the Seppi Korda forehand in this match. There was a lot of spraying from Seppi, who was also far from his best, but man, 1-2 in your clay court debut over a guy who just 1-2 Davidovich Fokina looked real good with his weight of shot in doing so. Sinner's just next level. He is the best tennis player in the world right now. 23-1 here this season. 66-11 over his last 52 weeks. He's flirting with a 90% win percentage now. I mean, he's accomplished that for a 9-month stretch, but he's flirting with it for a 52-week stretch. Again, when you're over the 90% threshold, you probably need at least two slams in a 52-week time span. But if Sinner wins the French Open, his run from the start of Wimbledon last year where he made the semis to the end of that hypothetical French Open win, we'd have to start talking about, is it Pantheon level? And obviously a lot of that will be based upon how he performs, not just this week in Monte Carlo, but Madrid, Rome, Barcelona, all these different things on the horizon. Your reminder, Jannik Sinner didn't play a ton of clay court tennis last year, dealt with a bunch of different injuries, 8-3 overall during that clay court portion. Now, it is worth noting 2022, he goes 15-4 overall on the clay, quartered Monte Carlo, quartered Rome, lost round of 16, but was forced to withdraw due to injury at Roland Garros. I mean, again, that 2022 season, excuse me, I remember it because I was at Tennis Channel at the time calling the event that week, when Sinner beat Alcaraz in the Umag final in three sets, and the level he played down a first set 7-6, just again, his pace, the way he overwhelmed Alcaraz. Even before that, you go to earlier seasons, I think there were flashes of it. I think his first big result, right, was that 2020 French Open where he beat Zverev on his way to the Roland Garros quarterfinal. I mean, again, it's the weight of shot. It's the action on his shot should rip through these courts so effectively. But now that, again, he moves so well, it's so fluidly. It's great to see the improved fluidity. Now he really is an elite mover. But that improved fluidity that's been so evident on hard courts over the last 6 months, it's one match, but it was fairly evident in his opening match in Monte Carlo. And again, 2-1. That's a response to the rest of the field of, no, my level, it's going to carry over here. Obviously, a disappointing loss. Again, another, you know, Seppi Korda, you would have loved to see him play that match quarter. He was far closer. He was far quarter. Play that match closer. He was far from his best. But Sinner's the story. I just think, again, the level he is playing, he's number one in hold percentage, number two in break percentage. It's must-watch television. Just every match he hits something from a corner or some sort of plus-one perfection that just, it's as well as the sport can be played. And again, you're talking about the number two player in the world, but I think even for casual sports fans, I think Jannik Sinner's the sort of guy you can show to your sports-loving but maybe not tennis-centric friends, and they'll watch him play and go, who is this guy? How is someone so skinny hitting the ball this big? How does it all work? And there's just a cool, calm collectedness about him. Again, he acts like he's been there before. And for 9 months consecutively. He has been there at the top of this game, 66-11 over his last 52 weeks. The guy's still just 22 years old. Again, 2-1, cruises into round number three, where a date with Jan Leonard Struff awaits him. Second most impressive on the day, without question, Stefanos Tsitsipas. And look, I'm not going to say that Tsitsipas's opponent, Tomas Martin Echeverry, pushed him in any sort of serious sense, because Echeverry was rough throughout the course of this match against Tsitsipas, though. 6-1, 6-love over a guy who made the Roland Garros quarterfinals last year. I think that's pretty clearly Tsitsipas's best victory in a tour-level event this year. You know, again, Echeverry was coming off of a win over Nicolas Jarry. Now, Echeverry won just 14% of his second serve points, just 42% of his first serve points in this match. Everything was just kind of sitting up and hanging there for Tsitsipas to swing through. But boy, was he swinging through things comfortably. And there was a passing shot he hit first set. You know, again, Echeverry tried to go behind Tsitsipas. Tsitsipas was trying to protect his backhand corner, so Echeverry tried to catch him off guard and test the forehand on the run. It was a reminder that once we get to the clay courts, you really can't test that Tsitsipas on the run forehand, because, oh my God, does he hit it excellently. And from the shoestrings, this forehand pass he hits, just the strength, the creativity, the ability, improvisational skill to do that, it's just a stark reminder that on this surface, again, two matches consecutively, and I know Laszlo Gera had to retire early, but boy, was Tsitsipas's forehand the biggest weapon on the court, and it wasn't particularly close. And just how much more comfortable he is still executing his first serve and plus one playbook on this surface compared to everyone else's weapons, who clearly just aren't quite as effective. Again, he finds the backhand more successfully. I really like this high, elevated swing through one-handed backhand defensive shot he was hitting, and it felt like, and it helps when you're up 6-1, 3-0 at that point, you're like, might as well take some backhand swings. I've got this massive lead. What do I have to lose? But I just haven't seen him swing through his backhand that comfortably in so long. And then again, because he was comfortable swinging through that backhand corner, able to lull players in backhand cross-court exchanges to leave something a little bit more in the center. And then the moment he gets a forehand, now you're on his terms. Now the weight of that shot is so tremendous. This is Tsitsipas' best victory of the season, in my opinion, pretty unequivocally. It's his best victory in quite some time, I would argue, as well. I mean, you know, again, he beat Tiafoe at Indian Wells, okay. I just think the context of I don't know. Like, I just thought the level in this one was particularly higher. And look, now he gets the massive test. And I loved, I mentioned this yesterday, that Medvedev quarter of the draw, Medvedev versus Khachanov, Tsitsipas versus Zverev, the 2017 Next Gen's dream. That's a fascinating section of the draw, because whomever comes out of it, it emerges with a lot of confidence here at the start of the clay court season. And if it's Stefanos Tsitsipas, probably the guy who needs that confidence more than any of the other three in the group. Yeah, like, now you have to take notice. Now you have to start asking the question, you know what? Maybe the bottom hasn't fallen off from Tsitsipas. Maybe, again, the scout is very much out on him on hard courts, and that's going to have to be adjustment, and maybe you adjust your parameters for your expectations for him on that surface. But if he comes out of this, even tomorrow's the real test. I want to see that matchup with Zverev. Obviously, two guys who have played each other as much as just about any other opponent in their careers. Let's roll the balls out. Let's play some tennis. That one's going to be really fun. We'll see if Tsitsipas' plus one prowess, if his backhand can hold up against that Zverev test. Obviously, Monte Carlo's always been a place he's been able to succeed. But again, 6-1, 6-love. That's pretty clearly his best victory of the season. The other big headline, I would say, from the day involved our one upset. Now, again, it's kind of been a pattern. Andrei Rublev, for the past three events, clearly you look for him. First round loss in Miami, second match loss at Indian Wells, now knocked out in his first match here in Monte Carlo. He's lost four of his last five, dating back to that default to Bublik in the Dubai semifinal. I mean, it was a mess, and it just feels like, and I've said this, if you listen to, I apologize that I keep citing myself, but I just want to make clear that it's been pretty clear to me over the course of his matches, and I can point out some in particular. And you know, when I think of all the times he's lost first sets this year, it just feels like he keeps getting off to these slow starts where he's just down a break so quickly and playing from behind. And obviously, in that first set, the inside-out forehand return, Popperin ripped as a winner to break for the 3-2, I believe it was lead, or 4-2 lead at the time. Like, I suppose there's not much Rublev can do there, kind of hit a kick serve. I mean, Popperin was so far outside the alley, that was a make-or-break take for Alexei Popperin, but it was the amount of success Popperin had taking the backhand line in particular. It just felt like that shot was available to him whenever he wanted it, and there was never a counter or an adjustment from Rublev to take that shot away. He never wanted to go into the belly of the beast of that forehand because, again, that forehand wing can be massive for Alexei Popperin, but some scholars would argue Rublev just as successful on that side. I was surprised he didn't try to play through that Popperin forehand wing more frequently. You know, Rublev, for what it's worth, did go up a break early in that second set, but ceded that break back to Popperin. And then, again, just the frustration is so evident on the face of Andrei Rublev, and Alexei Popperin is a rhythm, momentum guy, and all the reasons to be inspired, particularly after he broke back in the second set, were there. And you just felt the moment he got that break back again, with how aggressive he was, offered Rublev no sort of rhythm throughout the course of this match, and was more comfortable missing a backhand line down a redirect than he was trying to play a prolonged rally with Rublev. Although, again, Popperin's sneaky physical for guys 6'4", 6'5", those sorts of weapons still. Again, fourth loss in five consecutive matches and three consecutive losses for Andrei Rublev, who is the defending champion in Monte Carlo. And with this loss now, you look for him in the ATP Live rankings. He actually didn't drop any spots. Now, still number six, but he goes from up 1,300 points to up fewer than 300 points now on Hubi Hurkacz, who's in that number seven spot, and now the race for six. I mean, Zverev is up 1,500 points on Rublev, that gap between five and six, but the race for six, with Rublev at 3,900, there are one, two, three, four, five, six, seven players, the other six of whom all still alive in Monte Carlo, who can all make pushes for that number six spot, who are all within 800 points of Andrei Rublev. Stefanos Tsitsipas, by the way, the final guy at number 12 in the live rankings on that list. That feels right. Again, there's a big gap between Djokovic through Medvedev and the rest of the field. Then there's a big gap between those four and Zverev. Then a big gap between Zverev and who's next. That's kind of the landscape we see unfolding. That makes sense. And what makes this Monte Carlo draw, again, so exciting is, Rublev aside, just about everyone else is still alive as we reach, again, the business end of things here in Monte Carlo, round of 16, et cetera, moving forward to rapid fire some takes from the rest of the day's action. How about Hubi Hurkacz? Was it his best tennis today against Roberto Bautista Agut? Some scholars would argue no, but in a 5-6 win that saw him broken just once, like when 79% of his first serves was sniffing double-digit aces again. You look for Hubi Hurkacz now since the start of Wimbledon last year. Is he Yannick Sinner good? No. Is he top eight good? Absolutely in the conversation. He's 44-17 overall over his since the start of last year's Wimbledon. Excuse me. He's made quarterfinals or further in 8 of the 16 tour-level events he's played coming into Monte Carlo. If you're in the final eight of 8 of 16, and again, one of those is a Shanghai Masters run where he wins that title. One of them, Wimbledon, I think he made round of 16 last year. You look for him in Australia this year. He was able to make quarterfinals, Paris quarterfinals, Cincy semifinals. This success is coming at real events, events with significant fields, and Hubi keeps up ending up in the final eight, and it helps to be able to hold serve as frequently as he does, 90.5%, dare I say the heir apparent to the John Isner Award of who's the best or most frequent serve bot category, whatever you want to say, like he might be in that, but obviously there's a fluidity, a creativity, and a grindiness to his backhand that Isner never possessed. Still, the point is, 44-17, quarterfinals in 8 of his last 16, and now he's won his first 6 matches on clay to start this 2024 season. Hubi Hurkacz is in the top 8 discussion, and obviously that's not a hot take. Right now he's 7th in the points race, he's 7th in the live rankings. But he should be at those positions, and I don't think he's a guy you'd ever consider tier 2 prior to maybe the start of this year. I think it's time to have that discussion of, okay, obviously we know who the top four guys are. Who's the best of the rest? And I know he doesn't have the massive slam catalog of success to point to, but everything else is just about there. And this is his most consistent stretch of his career. He's 27 years old. He should be in the prime of his career. Again, he should beat Roberto Bautista Agut, but it was also his sixth match in, what, 9 days played or 10 days of competition, and he does get through in straight sets. Hubie keeps rolling. Again, the only upset of the day was Rublev, or I should say the only seed knocked out on the day was Rublev. You look at all of the other day's results, fairly straightforward. Medvedev was a brick wall against Gael Monfils, 6-2, 6-4 victory for the world number four as he kicks off his clay court campaign. Just a fun fact, Daniil Medvedev, and I ran the numbers for his career. I posted this on Twitter if you want to see them. But let's go since he became Daniil Medvedev, which is that 2019 season. Since he's been Daniil freaking Medvedev, 27-15 overall on clay. So again, that's what, a 64% win percentage. Break serve 30.9% of the time. Obviously, everyone breaks serve a little bit more on clay, but that's still a top five number amongst top 50 players on clay courts and flirts with the best of the best. Now, the hold percentage, 78.1, a little bit lower, but he's made 5 quarterfinals or further in his last 16 events. Obviously, last year wins his first title on clay in Rome. He's much more comfortable as a mover now on this surface. And again, just the degree of physicality he brings, the funkiness of his forehand, how well he changes direction with it, how well he catches you off guard with where he goes with it, the fact that he can play the drop shot pretty comfortably, the fact that he's pretty comfortable as a volleyer as well. Like, he's going to remain a tough out on this surface. Obviously, you don't maybe put him in that top tier the way Sinner, Alcaraz, and Djokovic all stay there regardless of what surface they're on here on clay. But he doesn't dip below tier two, is what I'm trying to remind everyone. And I don't know if anyone even had him dipping below tier two. But look, Casper Ruud should probably still be a favorite if he faced Daniil Medvedev on a clay court. But that match would be closer than you'd think. Like, I don't think he'd be a prohibitive favorite. I would actually be fascinated to see what the line would be on that match, what the betting odds would be, what the populace thinks, because I wonder how you would try to handicap that match, because he's still Daniil freaking Medvedev and just such a tough competitor on this surface. So again, that was an impressive victory, just watching him not miss a backhand. It was funny how, regardless of surface, like, he's just still Daniil freaking Medvedev. And again, there's more clay court success in that resume of late than you would expect. Medvedev, a straight set winner over Gael Monfils to set up the date with Karen Khachanov. Other winners on the day, again, pretty straightforward. Impressed by Casper Ruud, 2-4 over Alejandro Tabilo, another match where he wins over 90% of his first serve points, and just he is executing his plus one with such efficiency. He's in shape. He was comfortable with Tabilo serving into his backhand and serving into his body, and just the depth on the return of serve, again, how comfortable he is as a mover. Casper Ruud looked the part, even with how well Hubie Hurkacz is serving. I would still make him the favorite to advance out of that quarter, but that quarter's wide open because, again, your other winners on the day in that section, Hubie Hurkacz now going to take on Casper Ruud in the round of 16, but the top half, that's where things get funky. Ugo Humbert into the round of 16, a 1-4 win over Zheng Jiezhen. That looked like two fish just out of water. And then the other winner in that section, I said this on yesterday's draw preview, Lorenzo Sonego had a massive opportunity, and let's keep in mind, Sonego now in his late 20s, 28 years old, as a matter of fact, he's fallen out of the top 50. He is not in the Italian resurgence of 2024. Lorenzo Sonego has not been a part of that conversation. Lucky loser who gets the spot of Carlos Alcaraz after Alcaraz was forced to withdraw 4-5. He knocks out FAA, just was able to put some pressure on the FAA forehand and able to find the FAA backhand consistently, able to weather kind of the FAA hot streaks. It just, again, it was a solid performance from the Italian veteran. He just looked the more comfortable of the two on the surface. Disappointing result for Felix, who's never been the most comfortable on the clay, but that felt like a real opportunity. Still, Sonego, he's an underdog according to Tennis Abstract, and man, if Humbert makes a Masters 1000 quarter on clay to start. Like, again, this will probably be his best clay court result of the season, but heck, it's the one result he kind of needs to keep himself in that top 16 hunt and keep himself, or dare I say, even in the top 8 hunt heading into a grass court season, summer hard court season where we know he can thrive. Huge opportunity for both guys in that round of 16 matchup coming up. And then, again, your other winner on the day, Karen Khachanov. That's a really impressive three-set win, 4-6, 6-4, 6-3 over Francisco Cerúndolo. Continues to be a top eight guy. Alex Diemenauer, 2-6-6, 2-6-3. He's just moving so much more comfortably on this surface than he was even as recently as last year. And again, another guy who has an opportunity to make a quarterfinal of a 1,000-level event on clay to kick off this clay court season. Diemenauer up next, going to take on fellow Aussie Alexi Popperin. That's a really fun set, and it speaks to the next gen has truly set in. Djokovic, Musetti, Diemenauer, Popperin, three of the four born 96 or later. Sonego, I think, is my age or a 96, but Humbert, Hurkacz, Ruud, all 96 or later. Zverev, Tsitsipas, Khachanov, Medvedev, all 96 or later. You know, again, Sinner, Rune if he gets through Nadal. So Dimitrov, Struff, and Djokovic, the only players born before 1996. The generational shift has happened, and it's 2024. The generational shift should have happened, but you feel it more present looking at each and every one of these draws. And again, after 3 years in the wilderness, I feel like we're starting to finally see a little bit of a picture of who are the best players of the world. What might the next, I'm not going to say half decade, but what might this next three-year stretch look like? Monte Carlo is certainly going to provide us some more significant data points in trying to figure that out. That is everything that unfolded Wednesday in Monte Carlo. Of course, I will be back tomorrow to break down all of Thursday's action. A thank you, as always, to our super producer, Daniel Westoff, for the of an editing job he does day in, day out, making all of our content possible. Reminder, it's our final weekend of 2024 college tennis regular season coverage on ESPN+. We'll have coverage Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday there. We'll also have coverage Friday, Sunday on our Crack Rackets YouTube channel. So make sure you check that out, as I promise you will enjoy tuning into everything that happens in the college tennis universe. With that said, for our fantastic super producer, Daniel Westoff, our friends at Tennis Point, from all of us here at both Crack Rackets and the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. You know what we say. That's the break. I'll talk to you all tomorrow. Thanks, everyone.